The Hermit by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 2. The lowing of yaks and excited shouts from men and women roused the young monk. Sleepily rising to his feet, he drew his robe around him and made for the entrance to the cave, determined not to miss any excitement. By the lake, men were milling, trying to harness yaks which stood in the water and could not be persuaded to come out. At last, losing his patience, a young trader dashed into the water and tripped over a submerged root. Arms of flail, he fell face down with a resounding smack. Great gouts of water splashed up, and the yaks, now frightened, lumbered ashore. The young trader, covered in slimy mud and looking extremely foolish, scrambled ashore to the hoots of laughter from his friends. Soon the tents were rolled up, the cooking utensils well burnished by sand, packed, and the whole trading caravan moved slowly off to the monotonous creaking of harness and the shouts of men in vain trying to urge more speed from the ponderous animals. Sadly, the young monk stood with hands shading his eyes from the rising sun's glare. Sadly, he stood and stared into the distance long after the noise had ceased. Oh, why, he thought, could not he have been a trader and travel to far-off places? Why did he always have to study things which no one else seemed to have to study? He wanted to be a trader, or a boatman on the happy river. He wanted to move around, go places, see things. Little did he know, then, that he would go places and see things until his body craved peace and his soul ached for rest. Little did he think, then, that he would wander the face of the earth and suffer unbelievable torments. Now, he just wanted to be a trader or a boatman, anything but what he was. Slowly, with downcast head, he picked up the betwigged branch and re-entered the cave to sweep the floor and strew fresh sand. The old hermit appeared. Even to the inexperienced gaze of the younger man, he was visibly failing. With a gasp, he settled himself and croaked, "My time is approaching, but I cannot leave until I've given you all the knowledge that is mine. Here are special and very potent herbal drops given to me by your very famous guide for just such an occasion. Should I collapse and you fear for my life, pour 6 drops into my mouth, and I shall revive. I am forbidden to leave my body until I have finished my task." He fumbled in his robes and produced a little stone bottle, which the younger monk took with the greatest care. "Now we will continue," said the old man. "You can eat when I am tired and have to rest a while. Now, listen, and take the greatest care to remember. Let not your attention wander, for this is worth more than my life, and worth more than yours. It is knowledge to be preserved and passed on when the time is ripe." After resting for some moments, he appeared to regain strength, and a little color crept back to his cheeks. Settling himself rather more comfortably, he said, "You will have to remember all I have told you so far. Let us then continue." The discussion was prolonged, in my opinion, very heated, but eventually the babble of conversation ended. There was much shuffling of many feet. Then footsteps, small, light footsteps, like that of a bird tripping along to a grub. Heavy footsteps, ponderous as the lumbering walk of a heavily laden yak. Footsteps which puzzled me profoundly, for some of them seemed to be made not by humans such as I knew. But my thoughts on the matter of footsteps were suddenly ended. A hand grasped me by the arm and a voice said, "Come with us." Another hand grasped my other arm and I was led up a path which to my bare feet felt as though it were metal. The blind developed other senses. I sensed that we were traversing some sort of metal tube, although how that could be I could not possibly imagine. The old man stopped as though to picture again in his mind that unforgettable experience. Then he continued. Soon we reached a more spacious area, as I could determine by the changed echoes. There was a metallic sliding sound in front of me, and one of the men leading me spoke in a very respectful voice to someone obviously very superior to him. What was said, I have no means of knowing, for it was said in a peculiar language, a language of pipings and chirps. In answer to what was evidently an elder, I was pushed forward, and the metallic substance slid shut with a soft thunk behind me. I stood there, feeling the gaze of someone staring hard. There was a rustle of fabric, and the creak of what I imagined to be a seat similar to that which had seated me. Then a thin and bony hand took my right hand and led me forward. The hermit paused briefly and chuckled. Can you imagine my feelings? I was in a living miracle. I knew not what was before me, and had to trust without hesitation those who led me. This person at last spoke to me in my own language. "Sit here," he said, at the same time pushing me gently down. I gasped with horror and fright. I felt as though falling into a bed of feathers. Then the seat, or whatever it was, gripped me most intimately, where I was not used to being gripped. At the sides there were struts, or arms, presumably designed to prevent one from falling off if one slept through the strange softness. The person facing me seemed almost amused at my reactions. I could tell from an ill-suppressed laugh, but many people seem to derive amusement from the plight of those who cannot see. "You feel strange and afraid," said the voice of the person opposite me. That definitely was an understatement. "Be not alarmed," he continued, "for you will not be harmed in any way. Our tests show that you have a most eidetic memory, so you are going to have information which you will never forget, and which you will much later pass on to another who will come your way." It all seemed mysterious and very frightening, in spite of the assurances. I said nothing, but sat quietly and waited for the next remarks, which were not long in coming. "You are going to see," continued the voice, "all the past, the birth of your world, the origin of gods, and why chariots flame across the sky to your great concern." "Respected sir," I exclaimed, "you used the word see, but my eyes have been removed. I am blind. I have no sight at all." There was a muttered exclamation indicative of exasperation, and the rejoinder with some asperity. "We know all about you, more than you will ever know. Your eyes have been removed, but the optic nerve is still there. With our science, we can connect to the optic nerve, and you will see what we want you to see." "Will that mean that I shall permanently have sight again?" I asked. "No, it will not," came the reply. "We are using you for a purpose. To permanently give you sight would be to let you loose upon the world with a device far in advance of this world's science, and that is not permitted. Now, enough talk. I will summon my assistants." Soon there came a respectful knock, followed by the metallic sliding noise. There was a conversation. Evidently, two people had entered. I felt my seat moving, and I tried to jump up. To my horror, I felt that I was completely restrained. I could not move, not even so much as a finger. Fully conscious, I was moved along in this strange seat, which appeared to slide easily in any direction. We moved along passageways, where the echoes gave me many strange impressions. Eventually, there came a sharp turn to the seat, and most remarkable odors assailed my twitching nostrils. We stopped at a muttered command, and Hans grasped me by the legs and under the shoulders. Easily I was lifted up, to the side, and straight down. I was alarmed. Terrified would be a more correct word. That terror increased when a tight band was placed around my arm, just above the elbow. The pressure increased, so that it felt as though my arm was swelling. Then came a prick to my left ankle, and a most extraordinary sensation, as if something was being slid inside me. A further command was given, and at my temples I felt two ice-cold discs. There was a buzz as of a bee droning in the distance, and I felt my consciousness fading away. Bright flashes of flame flickered across my vision. Streaks of green, red, purple, all colors. Then I screamed. I had no vision. I must therefore be in the land of devils, and they were preparing torments for me. A sharp stab of pain, just a pinprick, really, and my terror subsided. I just did not care any more. A voice spoke to me in my own language, saying, "Be not afraid. We're not going to hurt you. We are now adjusting so that you will see. What color do you see now?" So I forgot my fear while I said, when I saw red, when I saw green, and all other colors. Then I yelled with astonishment. I could see. But that which I could see was so strange that I could scarce comprehend any of it. But how does one describe the indescribable? How does one endeavor to picture a scene to another when in one's language there are no words which are appropriate, when there are no concepts which might fit the case? Here in our Tibet, we are well provided with words and phrases devoted to gods and devils, but when one comes to dealing with the works of gods or devils, I don't know which. What can one do? What can one say? How can one picture? I can only say what I saw, but my sight was not in the location of my body. And with my sight, I could see myself. It was a most unnerving experience, an experience which I never want to repeat. But let me start at the beginning. One of the voices had asked me to say when I saw red, to say when I saw green and other colors, and then there was this terrific experience, this white, stupendous flash, and I found that I was gazing, for that's the only word which seems appropriate, at a scene entirely alien to everything I had known. I was reclining, half lying, half sitting, propped up on what seemed to be a metallic platform. It seemed to be supported on one solitary pillar, and I was for a moment very afraid that the whole device would topple over and me with it. The general atmosphere was of such cleanliness that I had never known. The walls of some shiny material were spotless. They were a greenish tinge, very pleasant, very soothing. About this strange room, which was a very large room indeed, according to my standards, there were massive pieces of equipment which I just cannot tell you about, because there are no words which would in any way convey their strangeness to you. But the people in that room, they gave me a stupendous shock, and that gave me a shock that almost sent me off raving and screaming. And then I thought, perhaps this is just a distortion caused by some trick of this artificial vision which they had given, no, lent to me. There was a man standing by the side of some machine. I judged that he was about twice the height of our biggest proctors. I should say he was about 14 feet high, and he had the most extraordinary conical-shaped head, a head which went up almost like the small end of an egg. He was completely hairless, and he was immense. He seemed to be clad in some kind of greenish robe. They were all covered in green cloth, by the way, which reached from his neck right down to his ankles, and, extraordinary thought, covered the arms as far as the wrists. I was horrified to look at the hands and find that there was a sort of skin over them. As I gazed from one to the other, they all had this strange coating on the hands, and I wondered what the religious significance of that could be. Or did they think I was unclean and they might catch something from me? My gaze wandered from this giant. There were two whom I should judge by their contours to be female. One was very dark, and one was very light. One had a type of kinky hair, while the other had a straight sort of white hair, but I have never been experienced in the matter of females, and so that is a subject which we should not discuss, nor should it interest you. The two females were gazing at me, and then one moved her hand in the direction at which I had not yet looked. There I saw a most extraordinary thing. A dwarf, a gnome, a very, very small body, a body like that of a 5-year-old child, I thought. But the head, the head was immense. A great dome of a skull, hairless too, not a trace of hair anywhere in sight on this one. The chin was small, very small indeed, and the mouth was not a mouth as same as we have, but seemed to be more of a triangular orifice. The nose was slight, not a protuberance so much as a ridge. This was obviously the most important person, because the others looked with such deferential respect in his direction. But then, this female moved her hand again, and a voice from a person whom I had not noticed before spoke in my own language, saying, "Look forward. Do you see yourself?" With that, the speaker came into my range of vision. He seemed to be the most normal. He seemed to be, well, I should say that, dressed up, he could appear as a trader, perhaps an Indian trader, so you know how normal he was. He walked forward and pointed to some very shiny substance. I gazed at it, at least I suppose I did, but my sight was outside of my body. I had no eyes, so where had they put the thing which was seeing for me? And then I saw, on a little platform attached to this strange metal bench on which I reclined, I saw a form of box. I was at the point of wondering how I could see the thing, if it was that with which I was seeing, when it occurred to me that the thing in front, the shiny thing, was some form of reflector. The most normal man moved that reflector slightly, altered its angle or tilt, and then I did shout with horror and consternation, because I saw myself lying upon the platform. I had seen myself before my eyes were taken from me. At times when I had gone to the water's edge and gone to drink, I had seen my reflection in the placid stream, so I could recognize myself. But here, in this reflecting surface, I saw an emaciated figure looking almost at the point of death. There was a band around an arm and a band around an ankle. Strange tubes came from those bands to where I saw not. But a tube protruded from a nostril, and that went to some transparent bottle tied to a metal rod beside me. But the head, that I can hardly recollect and stay calm. From the head, just above the forehead, protruded a number of pieces of metal, with what seemed to be strings coming from those protrusions. The strings led mainly to the box, which I had seen on the small metal platform beside me. I imagined that it was an extension of my optic nerve going to that black box. But I looked with increasing horror and went to tear the things from me and found I still could not move at all, not a finger. I could just lie there and gaze at this strange thing that was happening to me. The normal-looking man put his hand out towards the black box, and had I been able to move, I would have flinched violently. I thought he was poking his fingers in my sight. The illusion was so complete. But instead, he moved the box a little and I had a different view. I could see around the back of the platform on which I rested. I could see two other people there. They looked fairly normal. One was white and the other was yellow as a Mongolian. They were just standing, looking at me, not winking, not taking any notice of me. They seemed rather bored with the whole affair, and I remember thinking then that if they were in my place, they certainly would not have been bored. The voice spoke again to me, saying, "Well, this, for a short time, is your sight. These tubes will feed you. There are other tubes which will drain you and attend to other functions. For the present, you will not be able to move, for we fear that if we do permit you to move in any way, you may, in frenzy, injure yourself. For your own protection, you are immobilized, but fear not, no ill will fall upon you. When we have finished, you will be returned to some other part of Tibet, with your health improved, and you will be normal except that you still will have no eyes. You will understand that you could not go about carrying this black box. He smiled slightly in my direction and stepped backwards out of my range of vision. People moved about me, checking various things. There were a number of strange circular things, like little windows, covered with the finest glass. But behind the glass there seemed to be nothing of importance, except a little pointer which moved or pointed at certain strange marks. It all meant nothing to me. I gave it a cursory glance, but it was so completely beyond my comprehension that I dismissed the affair as something beyond my understanding. Time passed, and I lay there, feeling neither refreshed nor tired, but almost in a state of stasis, rather without feeling. Certainly I was not suffering. Certainly I was not so worried now. I seemed to feel a subtle change in my body chemistry, and then, at the fringe of vision of this black box, I saw that one person was turning various protrusions, which came from a lot of glass tubings, all fitted to a metal frame. As the person turned these protrusions, the little things behind the small glass windows made different pointings. The smallest man, whom I had regarded as a dwarf, but who, it seemed, was the one in charge, said something. And then, into my range of vision, came the one who spoke to me in my own language, telling me that now they would put me to sleep, for a time, so that I should be refreshed. And when I had had nourishment and sleep, they would show me what it was that they had to show me. Barely had he finished speaking when my consciousness went again, as though switched off. Later I was to find that that indeed was the case. They had a device whereby instant and harmless unconsciousness could be induced at the flick of a finger. How long I slept or was unconscious I have no means of knowing. It could have been an hour or even a day. My waking was as instantaneous as had been my sleeping. One instant I was unconscious, the next instant I was wide awake. To my profound regret, my new sight was not in operation. I was as blind as before. Strange sounds assailed my ears, the clink of metal against metal, the tinkle of glass, then swift footsteps receding. Came the sliding, metallic sound, and all was quiet for a few moments. I lay there thinking, marveling at the strange events which had brought such turmoil to my life. Just as apprehension and anxiety were welling strongly within me, there came a distraction. Clackety footsteps, short and staccato, came to my hearing. Two sets of them, accompanied by the distant murmur of voices. The sounds increased and turned into my room. Again the metallic sliding and the two females, for thus I determined them to be, came towards me, still talking in their high, nervous tones. Both talking at the same time, or so it appeared to me. They stopped, one on each side of me, and then, horror of horrors, they whipped away my solitary covering. There was not a thing I could do about it. Powerless, motionless, I lay there at the mercy of these females. naked. Naked is the day when I was born. Naked before the gaze of these unknown women. Me, a monk, who knew nothing of women, who, let me confess it freely, was terrified of women. The old hermit stopped. The young monk stared at him in horror, thinking of the terrible indignity of such an event. Upon the hermit's forehead, a film of perspiration bedewed the tight skin as he relived this ghastly time. With shaking hands, he reached out for his bowl, which contained water. Taking a few sips, he set the bowl carefully back beside him. "But the worst was to follow," he faltered hesitatingly. "The young females rolled me on my side and forced a tube into an unmentionable portion of my body. Liquid entered me and I felt I would burst. Then, without any ceremony at all, I was lifted and a very cold container was placed below my nether regions. I must, in modesty, refrain from describing what happened next in front of those females. But that was merely a start. They washed my naked body all over and showed a most shameless familiarity with the private parts of the male body. I grew hot all over and was covered with the utmost confusion. Sharp rods of metal were pushed into me and the tube from my nostrils was snatched out and a fresh one forced roughly in. Then a cloth was drawn over me from my neck to below my feet. Still they were not finished. There came a painful tearing at my scalp, and many inexplicable things happened before a very sticky, irritating substance was plastered on. All the while, the young females chattered away and giggled as though devils had stolen their brains. After much time, there came again the metallic slither and heavier footsteps approached, whereas the chatter of the females ceased. The voice, in my own language, greeted me. "And how are you now?" "Terrible," I replied with feeling. "Your females stripped me naked and abused my body in a manner too shocking to credit." He appeared to derive intense amusement from my remarks. In fact, to be quite candid, he hooted with laughter, which did nothing to soothe my feelings. "We had to have you washed," he said. "We had to have your body cleaned of waste, and we had to feed you by the same method. Then the various tubes and electric connections had to be replaced with sterilized ones. The incision in your skull had to be inspected and redressed. There will only be faint scars when you leave here." The old hermit bent forward towards the young monk. "See," he said, "here upon my head, there are the five scars." The young monk rose to his feet and gazed with profound interest at the hermit's skull. "Yes, the marks were there, each about 2 inches long, each still showing a dead white depression." How fearsome, the young man thought, to have to undergo such an experience at the hand of females. Involuntarily he shuddered and sat down abruptly, as though fearing an attack from the rear. The hermit continued, "I was not mollified by such an assurance. Instead, I asked, but why was I so abused by females? Are there no men if such treatment is imperative?" My captor, for so I regarded him, laughed anew and replied, "My dear man, do not be so stupidly prudish. Your nude body, as such, meant nothing to them. Here we all go naked most of the time when we're off duty. The body is the temple of the over-self, and so is pure. Those who are prudish have prurient thoughts. As for the women attending you, that was their duty. They're nurses and have been trained in such work." "But why cannot I move?" I asked. "And why am I not permitted to see? This is torture." "You cannot move," he said, "because you might pull out the electrodes and injure yourself. Or you might injure our equipment. We are not permitting you to become too accustomed to sight again, because when you leave here, you will once more be blind. And the more you use sight here, the more you will forget the senses, tactile senses, which the blind develop. It would be torture if we gave you your sight until you left, for then you would be helpless. You are here not for your pleasure, but to hear and see and be a repository of knowledge for another who will come along and who will take that knowledge from you. Normally, this knowledge would be written, but we fear to start another of those sacred books or writings furors. From the knowledge you absorb and later pass on, this will be written. In the meantime, remember, you are here for our purpose, not yours." In the cave, all was still. The old hermit paused before saying, "Let me pause for the nonce. I must rest a while. You must draw water and clean the cave. Barley has to be ground." "Shall I clean your inner cave first, venerable one?" asked the young monk. "No, I'll do that myself after I've rested, but you fetch extra sand for me and leave it here." He rummaged idly in a small recess in one of the stone walls. "After eating sampa and nothing but sampa for more than 80 years, he said, somewhat wistfully, "I feel a strange longing to taste other food, even once before passing on to where I shall not need any." He shook his white old head and added, "Probably the shock of different food would kill me." With that, he wandered into his private section of the cave, a section which the young monk had not entered. The young monk fetched a stout splintered branch from the entrance to the cave and vigorously set to loosening the impacted floor of the cave. Scraping away the hardened surface, he swept the whole mass out into the open and scattered it well away so as not to obstruct the entrance with the discarded material. Warily, he trudged and trudged again and again from lakeside to cave, carrying in his upturned robe as much sand as he could lift. Carefully, he strewed the floor with the fresh sand and tamped it down. 6 more trips to the shore, and he had enough sand for the old hermit. At the inner end of the cave was a smooth-topped rock with a water-worn depression formed eons ago. Into the depression he ladled 2 handfuls of barley. The heavy, rounded stone nearby was the obvious tool kept for the purpose. Raising it with some effort, the young monk wondered how so ancient a man as the hermit, blind and enfeebled by deprivation, could manage it. But the barley, already roasted, had to be ground. Bringing the stone down with a resounding thud, he gave it a half rotation and back before raising the stone for another blow. Monotonously, he went on, pounding the barley, rotating the stone to crush the grains finer, scooping the pulverized flour out and replacing it with more grain. Thud, thud, thud. At last, with arms and back aching, he was satisfied with the amount. Wiping the rock and the stone with sand to remove clinging grain, he carefully put the ground material into the old box kept for that purpose and moved tiredly to the entrance to the cave. The late afternoon sun still shone warmly. The young monk lay on a rock and idly stirred his sampa with a forefinger to mix it. On a branch, a small bird perched, head to one side, watching everything with cheeky confidence. From the still waters of the lake, a large fish leapt in a successful attempt to catch a low-flying insect. Nearby, at the base of a tree, some rodent was busily burrowing, quite oblivious of the presence of the young monk. A cloud obscured the warmth of the sun's rays, and the young man shivered at the sudden chill. Jumping to his feet, he swilled his bowl clear and polished it with sand. The bird flew off, chirping in alarm, and the rodent scurried away from the tree trunk and watched events with a bright and beady eye. Stuffing the bowl in the front of his robe, the young monk hurried off to the cave. In the cave, the old hermit was sitting, no longer erect, but with his back against a wall. "I would like to feel the warmth of a fire upon me once again, for I have not been able to prepare a fire for myself during the past 60 years or more. Will you light one for me, and we will sit by the cave mouth?" "Most certainly," replied the young monk. "Do you have a flint or tinder?" "No, I have nothing but my bowl, my barley box, and my 2 robes. I do not even possess a blanket." So the young monk placed his own tattered blanket around the shoulders of the older man and went out into the open. A short distance from the cave, an old rock fall had littered the ground with debris. Here the young monk carefully selected 2 round flints, which fitted comfortably in his palm. Experimentally, he struck them together with a scraping motion and was gratified to obtain a thin stream of sparks at the first attempt. Putting the 2 flints in the front of his robe, he made his way to a dead and hollow tree, which obviously had been struck by lightning and killed a long time ago. In the hollow interior, he probed and scratched and eventually tore off handfuls of white, bone-dry wood, rotted and powdery. Carefully, he put it inside his robe and then picked up dry and brittle branches which were scattered all around the tree. Laden so that his strength was sorely taxed, he made his slow way back to the cave and thankfully dumped his load by the outer side of the entrance away from the prevailing wind, so that later the cave should not be filled with smoke. In the sandy soil, he scooped a shallow depression and, with his 2 flints beside him and dry sticks broken into lengths, he first laid a crisscross of small twigs and covered them with the rotten wood which he had rolled and twisted between his hands until it was reduced almost to the consistency of flour. Grimly, he bent over and, grasping the 2 flints, one in each hand, he struck them sideways together so that the poor little stream of sparks should land in the tinder wood. Again and again he tried, until at last a minute particle of flame appeared. Lowering himself so that his chest was on the ground, he carefully, oh so carefully, blew towards the precious spark. Slowly it grew brighter. Slowly the minute spot grew until the young man was able to stretch out his hand and place small dry twigs around the area, with some bridging the space. He blew and blew, and eventually had the satisfaction of seeing actual flame grow and move. No mother devoted more care to her firstborn than the young man devoted to the baby fire. Gradually it grew and became brighter. At last, triumphantly, he placed larger and larger sticks on the fire, which began to blaze eagerly. Into the cave he went to the old hermit. "Venerable one," the young monk said, "your fire is ready. May I assist you?" Into the old man's hand he placed a stout staff, and, helping him slowly to his feet, he put an arm around the thin body and helped him carefully to a place beside the fire and away from the smoke. "I will go and collect more wood for the night," said the young monk, "but first I will place these flints and tinder in the cave so that they will remain dry." So saying, he readjusted the blanket around his senior's shoulders, placed water beside him, and took the flints and tinder into the cave to a place beside the barley box. Leaving the cave, the young monk piled more wood on the fire and made sure the old man was safe from any chance flame. Then, setting off, he headed for the campsite, which the traders had used. They might have left some wood, he thought, but no, they had left no wood at all. Better than wood, though, they had overlooked a metal container. Obviously it had fallen unnoticed when the yaks were loaded, or when they were moving off. Perhaps another yak had bumped this container free, and it had fallen behind a rock. Now, to the young monk, it was treasure indeed. Now water could be heated. A stout spike lay beneath the can. What its purpose was, the young man could not even guess, but it would be useful for something, he was sure. Industriously poking around in the grove of trees, he soon had a very satisfactory pile of wood. Journey after journey he made back to the cave, dragging branches, carrying sticks. Not yet did he tell the old hermit of his finds. He wanted to be able to stay then and savor the full pleasure of the old man's satisfaction at having some hot water. Tea he had, for the trader had provided some, yet there had been no means of heating water until now. The last load of wood was too light. It would have been a wasted journey. The young monk wandered around looking for a suitable branch. By a thicket near the water's edge, he suddenly saw a pile of old rags. How they got there he could not say. Astonishment gave way to desire. He moved forward to pick up the rags and jumped a foot in the air when they groaned. Bending down, he saw that the rags was a man thin beyond belief. Around his neck he wore a kang, a slab of wood, each side of which was about 2.5 feet long. It was divided into two halves, held together at one side by a hinge, and at the opposite side by a hasp and a padlock. The center of the wood was shaped to fit around the neck of the wearer. The man was a living skeleton. The young man dropped to his knees and pushed aside the fronds of the thicket. Then, rising to his feet, he hurried to the water and filled his bowl. Quickly, he returned to the fallen man and dripped water into the slightly open mouth. The man stirred and opened his eyes. He sighed with contentment at the sight of the monk bending over him. "I tried to drink," he mumbled, "and fell in. With this board I floated and nearly drowned. I was in the water for days and just recently was able to climb out." He paused, exhausted. The young monk gave him more water, and then water well mixed with barley flour. "Can you get this thing off?" the man asked. "If you hit this lock sideways between two stones, it will spring open." The young man rose to his feet and went to the lakeside for two substantial stones. Returning, he placed a larger stone beneath one edge of the lock and gave it a hearty thwack with the other. "Try the other edge," said the man, "and hit it where that pin goes through. Then pull it down hard." Carefully, the young man turned the lock edge for edge and gave it a hearty bonk where advised. Pulling it downwards after, he was rewarded by a rusty creak and the lock came apart. Gently he opened the slab of wood and released the man's neck, which was chafed so deeply that the blood was oozing. "We will burn this," said the young monk. "Pity to waste it." End of chapter 2.